Okay, they don't go visit them, but do they at least, you know, say salam to them when they pass them on the street, say hello to them, you know, send them something to eat every now and then, you know, ask about their welfare? If they don't even go visit them, do they at least maintain some sort of relation with the poor or not? The imam replied, "Verily, you are listing virtues that people amongst us rarely possess." You know, in my tribe, rich people, even if they're Shia, they don't possess such characteristics, such virtues. The imam replied in the following way when he heard this, فَكَيْفَ تَزْعُمُ هَاُولَاءِ أَنَّهُمْ شِيَا. How is it possible for these people to assume and to claim that they are Shia and they are followers of the Imam alayhi salam? Right? These people do not possess the virtues that the Shia should possess. So how could they claim to be our Shias and our followers? These are the characteristics of the Imam alayhi salam. They would go visit the poor, their poor followers, and visit them and inquire about them and maintain relations with them. If we do not do the same, how can we be claimed to be followers of the Imams? Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the characteristics of the Shia in the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Spotlight. Israeli forces have significantly escalated the killing and repression of Palestinians in the occupied territories. Just a few hours ago, a Palestinian teenager was shot dead by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank, making it the fourth such killing in less than 48 hours, prompting the Palestinian Foreign Ministry to urge the International Criminal Court and other international bodies to break their silence. But will they? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will be discussing the root causes of this escalation in violent attacks against Palestinians, which began in the holy month of Ramadan, and how Palestinians are responding. Our guests tonight, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, joining us from Toronto, and also human rights activist Mohsin Naqvi from Houston, Texas.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's begin with Mr. Zafar Human rights... I'm sorry. What has emboldened Israelis, in your opinion, to this point where we see the unthinkable, including the killing of journalists that are being deliberately targeted?
Well, there is a long history of Zionist crimes being papered over by Western regimes as well as their media outlets. The way they describe, for instance, their crimes against the Palestinian people, they would refer to them as clashes or, you know, the conflict, etc., without identifying that Israel is the aggressor and the Palestinians are victims. Secondly, they seldom, if ever, mention that the Palestinians are under occupation. And as people under occupation, international law allows them to resist their occupiers by any means necessary. So when Israeli crimes are papered over in this manner, both by the Western regimes as well as their corporate media outlets, then that gives a green light to the Zionists to do whatever they like. Although recently a number of human rights organizations have pointed out to the fact that Israel is indulging in these crimes, that Israel is an apartheid regime. This includes the UN High Commission for Human Rights. It includes earlier on B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights organization. And then also Amnesty International came up with its report. And in April, there was the UN Special Rapporteur report of Professor Michael Link, who is now retired from that position. But he also issued a devastating report pointing out that Israel is involved in these horrendous crimes. But unfortunately, so long as the Western regimes and their media outlets continue to ignore Israeli crimes, then that obviously emboldens Israel and its occupation army to continue with these horrendous crimes against defenseless Palestinian people.
Mr. Nahfi, Israelis claim these killings and violent raids are in response to Palestinian stabbing attacks. And in some cases, they even go as far as blaming it on Palestinians, such as the case of Shireen Abu Akleh, Al Jazeera journalist. However, numbers don't lie, and the stats of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces are incomparably high. What does that indicate?
You see, the first thing is that Ms. Shireen was killed point blank while she was wearing a helmet and a vest that said press on it, and the bullet pierced through her helmet. When they try and blame these killings on the Palestinians, what they're trying to say is that when Palestinians come out to protest, it leads to the death of innocent journalists. This is exactly the kind of reaction that an arrogant power will have. They will never take responsibility for their own actions. We've seen this is exactly how the Saudi regime acts as well. It's very similar to the way Israel acts. And we've seen in the past that this is exactly how the United States of America acts as well, using false pretexts to attack the innocent. So when they try and push the burden upon the Palestinians, they're simply just trying to cover up their own crimes. As a matter of policy, the Israeli regime has a policy to expand its territories, to expand its control on this land. And the only way that they can do that is through aggression. And these bullying tactics are part of policy. This is not something that they do as a reaction to when Palestinians protest. All of this is done as a matter of policy. To give you an example, an Israeli court recently gave a judgment that the Palestinian region of Masafer Yatta should be occupied militarily by the Israeli. There's an entire judgment on this. Even though it'll displace thousands of Palestinians, they'll be expelled from their land, but the Israeli regime gives out a judgment, a formal judgment. So it's very apparent. There's not even an iota of a doubt that this aggression is a matter of policy and not a reaction to what's happening in Palestine right now.
So So, Mr. Bangash, why do you think Israel enjoys this level of impunity, and how far can this go?
First of all, we need to remember that Israel is a colonial settler entity. It is illegally occupying another people's land. And the reason why it is able to continue with this is that many of the Western regimes themselves are colonial settler entities. United States of America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, these are all colonial settler entities that occupied other people's lands. They actually carried out genocides against the indigenous populations and wiped them out. And Israel is involved in a similar campaign in the sense that, you know, when it was illegally transplanted or implanted on Palestine in 1948, it went about a campaign of ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. In 1948 itself, what is referred to as the Nakba, about, you know, 750,000 to a million Palestinians were driven out of their homes after massacres were perpetrated against the Palestinian people to create an environment of terror. And of course, you know, that's the campaign that Israel continues to pursue, confident in the belief that whatever it does, it will be protected from any accountability, whether by the Western regimes, the Western media, or any of these institutions, for instance, such as the International Criminal Court, which incidentally, the special prosecutor last year called for investigating Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people, which was particularly focused on Israel's war on Gaza of the year 2014. That, of course, special prosecutor is no longer there. The new prosecutor that took over, he's not really interested in pursuing these things. So unfortunately, the International Criminal Court has also become docile when it comes to Israeli crimes. Now, with respect to your question as to how long this can continue or how far the Israelis would go, the Israelis would stop at nothing. The only thing that would stop them is if there is a concerted effort, both by the Palestinian people as well as those people outside, particularly members of the resistance front, that would challenge these Zionist crimes and inflict some punishment on Israel, because Israel, the only thing that Israel understands is the language of force. And if a punishment is inflicted upon it, then it would not indulge in those kinds of crimes. And the simple example of that is as to what it faced against Hezbollah in Lebanon when they were driven out of much of Lebanese territory back in May of 2000, the year 2000. And then the Zionists made a mistake of attacking Lebanon again in 2006. But that was a crushing defeat for the Zionists. And we see that they have not perpetrated similar crimes again. So the overwhelming evidence is that if Israel is confronted and some punishment is given to it, in fact, it's delivered the same dose of medicine that it is administering to the Palestinian people, then it would stop its horrible crimes. Although, unless and until the Palestinians are able to obliterate this monstrosity called the Zionist ideology, and the Zionists learn to live like normal human beings, I'm afraid this situation would continue.
Mr. Naqvi, Mr. Bangash just pointed to punishment for Israel in order to stop these atrocities. On the other hand, we see that international bodies, including the ICC, have remained completely silent about all of these atrocities. Doesn't that mean that they've lost legitimacy?
To start off with, I believe that the ICC really was never legitimate as such. The ICC has always been under control of the great powers, without a doubt. The bias of the ICC is known to the world, where the atrocities committed by the US, in which, in false pretext, when they bombed Iraq, when they killed innocent Iraqis, no action was taken by the ICC. The bombings of Hiroshima, no actions were seen by the ICC. The International Court of Justice have proven to fail to have played any part in creating justice throughout the world. The ICC, I think the one prosecutor who may have played some role was Fatou Ben Sauda, but even now we see that she has no powers within the ICC anymore because of the stances that she took while being a prosecutor in the ICC. So as far as losing legitimacy is concerned, I definitely think that the ICC has lost all legitimacy whatsoever. But as far as punishment is concerned for Israel, you see, when someone is given punishment, after that punishment is over, that individual or country is relieved of the crimes that they have committed. The crime that Israel has committed is occupation on the land of the Palestinians. And the only legitimate punishment that I feel is justified is the expulsion of Israel as a country, and for there to be a democratic government where Jews, Muslims, Christians can live in peace on that land. That's the only probable solution to this conflict.
Mr. Bangish, a handful of Arab countries have normalized ties with Israel. Do you believe that to have had an effect on the increasing violent attacks against Palestinians?
Well, first of all, these regimes that have normalized relations with the Zionist regime have no legitimacy whatsoever. In fact, their own people have not accepted the so-called process of normalization. And the idea was, when this so-called normalization took place back in 2019, that Israel would stop its atrocities against the Palestinian people, etc., but it has not. And I don't think that we should put any confidence in these Arabian regimes that have normalized relations, and others probably would join them. I have no doubt about it, because these regimes themselves are illegitimate. So that process of normalization essentially was a way for the Zionists to deflect attention from their own illegitimacy as well as from the crimes that they were committing. And they continue to commit them. So in that sense, your question is right, that, you know, this has in fact emboldened the Zionists to continue with their crimes, because they feel that no matter what they do, there is not going to be any reaction, particularly from these Arabian regimes. But as I mentioned earlier, I think there is what is referred to as the resistance front that is becoming stronger by the day. The Palestinians are becoming more organized. They are becoming united. They are developing more and more sophisticated means of self-defense. And as time goes by, this level of punishment that would be inflicted on the Zionists is likely to increase. And obviously, a stage would reach whereby the benefits to Israel are not going to be as much as the losses to Israel. And so when the cost-benefit analysis is taken, I think that is the time when some of them, not necessarily all of them, but some of them would come to their senses and say, well, I think we really need to have a solution whereby it does not lead to the complete expulsion of all the Jewish people from Palestine. I think historically the Palestinian people have been very generous. They have never really targeted the Jewish people at all, and that's how it should be. It's the Zionist ideology, which is a racist ideology, that has to be eliminated so that all people, as Mohsin pointed out, whether it's they are Muslims, Christians, or Jews, that they live as equal citizens under the law in that holy land, which unfortunately has been turned into absolute hell for the Palestinian people.
Mr. Nalvi, you are a human rights activist. Tell us what you think is the responsibility of human rights organizations under the circumstances.
You see, at first, a lot of human rights organizations are of the opinion that filing cases in the ICC, for instance, or in other courts has an effect. In my opinion, it may create some form of pressure, but not really. Because we've already established the bias that the ICC and other powers to be have over this issue. The one thing that all human rights activists in the world can do is create awareness and to at least ban and propagate the banning of Israeli products. That's one thing that everyone, every conscious human being can do. Our dollars, our money should not be spent in advancing the cause of the Zionist regime. And unfortunately, we're so drenched in the usage of consumerism and capitalism that whether we want it or not, we do end up supporting the Zionist regime by consuming the products that they create, support, or make. So I think that's one thing that we can do. Another thing that we can do is we can create awareness amongst the masses and try to propagate the idea of a free Palestine and an end to the Zionist regime on social media. I think there are many Twitter storms that take place online. This is the least we can do. Take part in the soft war, which is also highly recommended by Sayyid Nasrullah and by Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei as well, that this is the least of our responsibilities. We all have a cell phone. We all have a computer. Take part in those hashtags. Contribute as much as you can on social media. Create awareness. Participate in protests that take place within your cities. If you're in colleges, organize seminars and educational gatherings where the masses can be educated on this issue and to the crimes of the Zionist entity. That's something that I feel we can do.
Mr. Bangash, it seems that the Palestinians are now evolving towards taking matters into their own hands rather than waiting for Arab states to stand up for them. How could this shift in policy change the equations?
Well, let's keep in mind that the Arab regimes were never really sincere about doing anything for the Palestinian people. They just used that as a pretext to remain in power themselves, because almost all of the Arab regimes are illegitimate. The Palestinians obviously need to take matters into their own hands. But the way I see it is that even initially, regrettably, the Palestinians were pursuing this secular agenda under the PLO, and now it's being pursuing the same agenda under the Palestinian Authority, which is basically a subcontractor for the Zionist regime. But on the other hand, we also have organizations like Hamas and Islamic Jihad. When this Islamic component comes into the picture, and this Islamic awareness that is motivating the Palestinian people, that they are able to carry out the kinds of resistance activities that they are doing. Naturally, it requires sacrifices, but they seem to be prepared to make those sacrifices in order to secure their legitimate, God-given, and human rights. And I think based on this, this changes the equation radically, because now the Palestinians cannot be dictated to by the Arab regimes. They cannot be misled into believing that, you know, the Zionists are prepared to concede their rights, etc. We need to be very clear that oppressors and occupiers have never, ever given the rights to the oppressed through negotiations. The oppressed have had to snatch these rights from their oppressors by defeating them and driving them out. That's the history of anti-colonialism. That's the history of all of these countries that have come, that have gained independence. So I think we need to be very clear about it. And definitely the Palestinians taking their own struggle into their own hands and deciding for themselves is what would ultimately bring them victory.
Mr. Nalfi, we're running out of time. We have less than 2 minutes left. So should we expect another intifada anytime soon? A quick answer.
So I think we're already in the midst of an intifada. A soft intifada is what I call it. The constant defense mechanisms that the resistance forces have created and the wounds that are being inflicted by the resistance forces to Israel and to the puppet masters of Israel are an indication that the intifada should have happened a long time back. The fact that Israel is not attacking on a larger scale is because they are not as equipped as they were a few years back. They have realized the power that the resistance forces have. And so if the intifada does take place, it will definitely be dictated by the resistance forces, and Israel, for the first time, will be on the defense. So if Rehber says that Israel does not have more than 25 years to exist, Sayyid Nasrullah in reply says that it may be less than 25 years. This is not a statement that we should be taken lightly. Practically speaking, it is true what we're seeing right now. The Israeli regime has truly become as weak as a spider's web. And if there is another intifada, which there will be, and that will be the end of Israel, inshallah. This is not an emotional statement. It can be proven politically. And if we had more time, I could have discussed further, inshallah.
Okay, Mohsen Naqvi, human rights activist from Houston, Texas, and Zafar Bangash, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought from Toronto. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts with us, and thanks for following this edition of Spotlight.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to our program Back to Reality with myself, Brother Yasir Ibrahim, and my dear beloved brother, Brother Sayyid Iman. On today's program, we will be discussing organs and organ donation. What is the rulings regarding it? Can we do it? Can we not do it? Is it good to do it or not? So I will pass it over to Sayyid. Inshallah, he can hopefully assist us in this regard.
Assalamu alaikum and thank you very much. Brother Yasir, we all know that, you know, the preservation of human life and health has a greater value in our religion. And if we think intellectually, or maybe if you look in the Quran and the Hadith, we will find out this notion. But, you know, I would just like to quote this small part of the verse. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. وَمَنْ أَحْيَاهَا فَكَأَنَّمَهَا أَحْيَاهَا النَّاسَ جَمِيعًا Surah Maidah, chapter Maidah and verse 32. So it's like, you know, saving one human being or saving one person is like saving a whole humanity, right? Mm-hmm. So this notion gives us the capacity of understanding that Islam really cares for human life. From the jurisprudence part, if you look at the things, you know, there is a little bit of difference in the fatawas Maraji Kiram, but all of them allows the organ donation, mm-hmm. if it's needed, really, you know, if there is a grave situation, if there is a situation in which other human beings can be saved, their lives can be saved, it is perfectly fine. One issue is there that they say that even in our times, since this is a new phenomenon, organ donation is a new phenomenon. I mean, it wasn't possible like 200 years ago.
Yeah, obviously.
You know, so in these times, in some countries, they have seen that they've experienced that people are reluctant to donate their organs. Mm-hmm. I really don't know the reasons, but as I said, since it's the first new phenomenon, that's the first thing. People are not used to of this thing, you know, that they used to bury their people, like, yeah, completely, yeah, in the ground. Not like, you know, like there is no heart or no kidneys,
yeah,
or no
something
lungs.
Something missing, yeah.
You know, it wasn't like that. And on the other part, they have a mistrust on the system, doctors, hospitals sometimes, mm-hmm. because there is a black market going on. In different parts of the world, and where they are, even like in Palestine, mm-hmm. I know that the Israelis, they take their kidneys or lungs or whatever they can get their hands on, yeah, from the people, and they sell it or they use it, you know. So there's a black market for the organ donation, and sometimes people do not like to donate because of the deservingness issue. They mm-hmm. think that, you know, we should not give this organ to that person because he is a criminal or he's a bad person, mm-hmm. or whatever. So, I mean, there are different reasons for it. But it was very amazing for me to know that a single person can donate 8 main organs. And alongside with organs, there's a new phenomenon. It's called tissue donation. Mm-hmm. Do you know about tissue donation? And they say that one person can donate enough so that he can save 80 different people by donating his tissues. By organs, I mean, you know, the kidneys, two kidneys, two lungs, one heart, one pancreas, intestines, and liver. Mm. These are the main, you know, organs. Yeah. And they said that newly, through the new research, they have added hands and a face as well. I don't know. I mean, this, it's a new research. So the tissues, you know, if you take a look at the tissues, it's a cornea in the eyes, for the sight, you know. Tendons for the joints.
The joints.
Heart valves and veins, skin. There is a burn victim sometimes.
Yeah, you can skin grafts.
And bones, birth tissues, they can also be used. So, I mean, it's amazing for me to know that, you know, these things are all... God has created such a you know, complex machine of humankind. But, you know, now we can use all of that in order to save lives.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of these medical dramas and stuff that come on TV and stuff that we would watch. And they would show these things like... like now you mentioned it, it was quite fascinating because obviously we know that we have motor movement, right? Our hands and all attached to nerves and motor skills and so on and so forth.
Yes.
So there was a kid, I remember they showed on one of these programs, whose hands were not working. There was a problem with his hands, either in an accident or something. So they got him a donation of hands. So they the old hands would be kind of cut off. And new hands would be sewn on, right? But not just sewn on. So obviously, when they do it, you have to attach nerves, you have to attach veins, you have to attach all sorts of other things.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. It's so complex.
It's very complex. It's very tricky. Like, you know, as someone has passed
away. He wrote it in a will that, you know, I want to donate.
Another issue of permission.
Yeah, exactly.
So. Permission is very important here as well. And who has permission? Like, for example, to add to said, like the wakil or the eldest son, if the maid has one or the father has the permission to give or to donate if need be, same as in medical. Like
I think I was reading one fatwa from one marja that they said that their family members can do this, but rest of them say no. It should be done. Yeah, it should be done in the life.
In the life, so you give permission in the life. Interesting, interesting one. Because I know, like in medical things that you read, the family can give permission. But besides Islamic, the medical thing.
Yeah.
Again, Islam has this. We have to go according to what the Maharaj have said. Yeah, so yeah, so the hands were given, and obviously you see that obviously the blood vessels and everything have to be reconnected, right? So not only that, so the blood has to flow into the hands, and then the body has to recognize it, and so it's quite fascinating. Like so, and again, like the blood type has to be the same, and it's a very intricate, very tricky thing. It was one of these programs I was watching. It's very like, but if you think about it, like the amount of things that you have to connect.
Oh yes,
I know, because you have your main arteries are here, the tissue, the muscle, the ligaments, everything has to be connected, right? And connected in a way that it works.
Exactly.
Right? Because you're just connected like a Lego piece, you know? Oh, it's just there, you know? It's just dangling. No, it connected so that it's functional. So and again. What is also fascinating, or something that for us to actually take into consideration, is that a doctor will not know if it will function until afterwards. They can do this; they can do the operation, like many heart transplants and stuff that you get. You say we do not know if the body will accept it or not.
This is another issue. Yeah,
we don't know if the body will accept it, so this is not in the doctor's hands. This is, you know, on a higher power.
Yes.
If Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wishes, or you know, as we can, or if the body, you know, is able to accept it or not, and all other criteria around it. So it's something interesting about that. I think maybe an issue that maybe some people may have regarding organ donation of a Muslim is maybe like the concept of ghusl as well. Maybe they don't want to see a person who they love so much in such a state, like cut up state. I don't know.
They probably feel like it's incomplete.
Exactly,
the body is incomplete while we are burying it.
Yeah, so it's a lot of different factors and criteria that can come about regarding this. I'm sure we can come around it. Like we can donate the body or after the ghusl, for example. That is something that we can. Somebody can say that. Like it's just like an opinion.
Yeah. But there must be a mechanism, even in the Islamic societies, I think, if it's proven that, you know, one person is so worthwhile that, you know, 80 lives can be saved or 80 problems can be solved from just one person's body. So, you know, and as I said, you know, that in the Quran and the Hadith, there is a greater mention of helping others and saving other lives. So there is a greater reward, right?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I think it's up to the fuqaha and the mustahideen, the scholars, to go and actually do more research on this. Something that, you know, we should actually promote that type of discussion in the seminary, in the hawza, for our great scholars to, you know, push them towards this type of understanding, or push them towards providing us with, you know, a clearer understanding of this. Like you said, it's not... There are differences of opinion, but like, for example, the concept of permission. But the thing that you mentioned of saving other people, wouldn't that be a greater sadaqatul jariyah, if you want to put it that?
Yeah.
You know, that flow of bounty that continues to that body that has, that soul rather, because the body is just a vessel. That's something for us also to understand, right? The body is just a vessel. It is our ruh, our soul, our nafs.
Yes, exactly.
There is something that is, as it is immaterial, it is indivisible. The body is just a vessel of it. So if we can provide that vessel for another soul, and for that soul then to progress, you know, our own soul may find better progress in this regard. Depending on who we give it to, and so on and so forth. So there must be this type of, as you mentioned, structures, organizations, means by how this is actually done. And the Islamic society should have the ability to do this, or should find the means of how this comes about, you know, together with the scholars and the doctors and whatever. They should come to kind of a consensus of how this should actually be done.
Because, I mean, it has been a practice in West for so long that, you know, even when I was in the States, when I received my driver license, on the back of my driver license, it says, you know, that I can pick and, you know, whatever organs I like to donate, you know, if I die, for example. So it was amazing for me to know that at that time. But in Islamic countries, usually we don't see that, you know,
concept of... In Pakistan, how is it? Is this like that?
No, I never heard of it. I even never heard of it. But, I mean, probably right now, there is a movement from some activists that, you know, they want to help people out, and we have EDI, a foundation. There's a guy who really helps. He died recently. So, but, you know, from the social and from a cultural perspective, I think we need to create awareness, because it's really easy for people to understand, you know, to help others. Helping is a very universal a notion, right?
Exactly.
Everyone understands that, you know, they need to help others out. So if we can focus and pay more attention to that and teach our children or in our society to people, maybe we can create understanding.
So maybe I think said we also maybe need to educate the Muslims, especially those in Muslim countries, because, you know, in terms of the education that we may have been given about the body, about helping others, about burial, you know, all these ideas, you know, may need to have a revised view. You know, maybe by one of our scholars, by maybe even us or somebody who wants to kind of forward this kind of thinking that, you know, if you have the... Because when we leave this body, we have no need for that heart. And to be fair, we don't, right? It was just a particular mechanism or tool that allowed me to live in this material world as I should be. When I die, that heart doesn't have anything besides it's going to feed the soil, to feed the insects. It's going to decompose. And that's it. It's going to go in terms of its material function. So if I have the ability for that to continue and to save somebody else, and again, putting certain conditions and so on and so forth within the foundations of Islam, saving another Muslim, saving another person who is deserving to be saved, in turn, again, who deserves to be saved and not is another discussion all in itself. In terms of that sadaqatul jariyah, and that particular thing that I
was given as a gift. Remember, the body is not mine. It's nothing.
Yes,
it's not mine. So I use it in a way that to please Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Why can't I then just use it in another way and give it to someone else to use? But again, this is not fiqh. We're not giving any fatawas here. We listen to our maraja and we hope and we pray that they can take the discussion further and provide provide answers that are, you know, people are dealing with today in the world.
Can we use religious places like members in the speeches to create awareness?
I think we can use, but again, it has to be with proper research and stuff. And then, within this way that, you know, obviously within the framework of the fatawa of the maraj of fiqh, I'm sure we can do it in that framework.
Yeah.
But until further research is not done, we are stuck to that particular framework.
What about media, like creating films, drama?
Yeah, that I'm sure that, you know,
internet.
The internet and stuff like this, people can create documentaries and stuff in terms of educating and so on and so forth. And education is very important. This ends this episode of Back to Reality. Our discussion between myself and Sayyid Ayman was on organ donation. And we hope and we pray that the great scholars of Islam can further promote this issue and provide greater clarity where it needs to be clarified. Inshallah, until our next episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt,
Indian-administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Families of prisoners and their advocates staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers, including more than 500 administrative detainees. Palestinian administrative detainees have been boycotting Israeli regime courts for more than 5 months to protest their administrative detention. Administrative detention is incarceration without trial or charge and has no time limit.
Administrative detainees are subjected to extreme suffering inside Israeli jails. They've been boycotting Israeli courts for more than 150 days to protest the detention without charge. Administrative detention is a racist policy and only causes pain and suffering to Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are being denied basic rights. Since the beginning of this year, Israeli regime forces have arrested some 3,000 Palestinians, including children and women.
Administrative detention is a systematic policy by the Israeli regime to hold Palestinian prisoners behind bars without trial for a very long time. Administrative detention can be renewed indefinitely, and it inflicts psychological pressure on the prisoners. We have all suffered from administrative detention inside Israeli jails.
During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Ministry of Detainees Affairs slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
We call on all international human rights organizations to come out of their silence and exert pressure on the Israeli regime to stop the inhumane administrative detention policy. Palestinian prisoners are freedom fighters and must be treated according to international laws and norms. The Israeli regime is violating conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
According to Palestinian prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Most of these detainees have been held with no charge or trial. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Russia is currently pounding the Donbass with its overwhelming air and artillery superiority. On the ground, Ukrainian soldiers post videos on social media from underneath the barrage. With each passing day, the odds of these soldiers surviving dwindles. As President Zelensky today made the staggering statement that between 60 and 100 Ukrainian soldiers are dying every day, with another 500 wounded.
As this conflict began, many voices around the world said that it was NATO's plan to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. Well, many Ukrainian units now are refusing to head into the hellstorm that is currently the Donbass, and as they say, to face certain death.
In an underreported phenomenon, in the last week I've seen more than half a dozen videos posted by Ukrainian units in which they declare they are refusing to fight. They say they are not being adequately trained or equipped, that their commanders are not going with them, and that they are being used as cannon fodder. This is the 115th Brigade. After refusing to fight, they were arrested for desertion. I have also seen videos of women in Ukraine protesting the predicament of their sons and husbands.
The Ukrainian armed forces can largely be categorized into three separate groups. First of all, you have the far-right, in some cases neo-Nazi militias, who do have some influence over Ukrainian politics, but are also ideologically driven to fight the Russians. You then have the well-trained Ukrainian soldiers, often trained in NATO countries, who are also, judging by various social media posts, bolstered, their ranks being bolstered by foreign mercenaries, in particular some former special forces fighters of NATO countries. They, of course, are highly trained and highly motivated. Then you have the National Guard, who are largely conscripted from the reserves. They are not very well trained. They haven't had fight experience, and they're far less motivated to fight. It's from these groups that these posted videos are coming from.
Yeah. Eduard Basurin, the deputy commander of the Donetsk People's Republic, who are fighting alongside the Russians.
The situation in Ukraine was being developed for one thing, to destabilize the Russian Federation. They are interested in this destabilization lasting for as long as possible, hoping that the citizens of Russian Federation will get tired. That's why they are interested in fighting to the last Ukrainian. So I have pity for the people in Ukraine. They are being eliminated, and I don't see the end of it. It's a big tragedy.
An apartment in Odessa. Military summons are plastered all over it. And here, another summons. In order to make up for their huge losses, Ukraine is increasingly calling up its reserves. And since the beginning of Russia's invasion, men of military age are not allowed to leave the country. While Ukrainian government propaganda relentlessly claims that the fight for Donbass is worth it, many Ukrainians would rather live in peace, even if it means territorial concessions. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Meeting in Brussels, EU leaders have agreed to place an embargo on 75% of Russian oil imports, increasing to 90% by the end of the year. 4 weeks ago, Moscow cut off gas supplies to EU countries Poland and Bulgaria. Now Russian gas to energy firms in Netherlands, Denmark and Germany is being switched off. EU leaders say they won't back down and will continue to send arms to Ukraine.
Since the beginning of the war, leaders and the member states stepped up and announced by now 200 billion euros in extra military spending.
It is clear that most citizens don't support the move.
We are still just speaking about sanctions, giving arms and stuff. We need to speak about peace and diplomacy.
I'm against spending more and more money for weapons. Because that is only going to end up in more conflict, because the only purpose of weapons is to use them against somebody else.
Amid criticism from US war hawks, German and French leaders have been defending their decision to keep lines of communication open with the Kremlin.
I do endorse discussing with Vladimir Putin on a regular basis, with very demanding approach and full transparency with President Zelensky.
Many analysts suggest the West created this crisis by not listening to Russia's security concerns, and apparent efforts to reach out to Moscow recently are merely a charade. EU leaders have now returned to their capitals, but senior officials here at the European Commission have told Press TV that work is well underway on a seventh round of sanctions targeting Russia. Peace activists continue to ask the question, why does all the emphasis seem to be on escalation rather than diplomacy? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For the first time since the presidential vote, France's unions marched nationwide, as the nation's public services will likely be under major attack for the next 5 years. Polls show President Emmanuel Macron will likely have almost as strong a grip over parliament as in his first term.
Unions repeatedly warned that the coronavirus was being instrumentalized to accelerate the long-standing neoliberal goal of defunding public services. Now they face a re-elected Macron who could be more powerful and confrontational than ever.
Macron's policies have meant the ending of so many social services and not replacing public servants who retire. This means those still working are doing double the amount of work as before, and that has led to burnout, illness, and even suicide attempts. If Macron would come talk to us, he would see that we are not being treated fairly, but I doubt he will.
New data shows the French economy has stagnated to the brink of a recession. Inflation in the Eurozone just hit its highest annual level since the currency began in 1999. That combination spells stagflation, something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy, and it comes after a decade of austerity measures which were allegedly supposed to strengthen the Eurozone.
The inflation index point has not been changed in a decade for civil servants, so our salaries have been constantly falling, and this was before this year's record increase in inflation. On top of this, they are asking us to work longer for the same pay, so our hourly wage is being reduced and we have less time away from work to be with our family and friends.
Despite the new lows in economic data, unions were not able to draw as many to march as in years past. Since the coronavirus restrictions began to be lifted last fall, many have noted that French protests are occurring less often and are smaller in size. It could be that, after a decade of mostly failed labor efforts, workers simply can't afford to miss work anymore. Or many have given up trying to influence Brussels or the French government. Or many French could be too scared to protest given what happened to the Yellow Vests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The British Parliament is in recess, but the letters are coming in. Only a week after a damning report by Sue Gray into Downing Street parties and Chancellor Rishi Sunak's £15 billion to help with the soaring cost of living.
The high command of the Conservative Party are in Operation Distraction now, with handouts, with talk about the Ukraine war, and many other things too. But the party is currently in Operation Frustration. They elected Boris Johnson to be a great asset when it came to winning votes. At the moment, he's losing them votes.
So far this week, three more letters of no confidence, including one from former Attorney General Jeremy Wright, who said that with regret, he concluded that for the good of this and future governments, the Prime Minister should step down. 37 MPs have now publicly questioned the Prime Minister's position. Out of those, two don't think he should go yet, eight are on the fence, and 27 want him to go now.
For a vote of no confidence to take place, 54 Conservative MPs will have to request it. But it's impossible to know exactly how many of them have already handed in their letters of no confidence because it's all done in secret. And some MPs are saying they're going to wait until after the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, celebrated this week, before they decide if Boris Johnson has to resign.
There isn't a clear successor to him that might bring them electoral advantage. And while they talk about the Jubilee, let's wait after that, they've mentioned the same thing about the Sue Gray report, about the police inquiry. In reality, they're waiting to see if this finally dies down or if this is a chronic condition, like malaria rather than COVID, that never goes away. And if it doesn't go away for Boris, then Boris is going to have to go away from the Conservatives.
There is also a question mark over what went down during COVID lockdowns in the Prime Minister's private apartment at the time. Allegations of another gathering on the day of Boris Johnson's birthday. But all eyes will be on the outcome of the upcoming by-elections beyond London, following the resignations of two disgraced Conservative MPs. Wakefield MP Imran Ahmed Khan, found guilty of sexually assaulting a teenage boy in 2008, and Tiverton and Honiton MP Neil Parish for watching pornography in Parliament. If the Tories lose, a ballot on Johnson's leadership is almost certain. Saeed Porizap, London.
A British government minister has launched a direct attack on the pro-Palestine boycott campaign against Israel, claiming that the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement fuels anti-Semitism, including hate crimes in Jewish-rich areas of London. Speaking while visiting Orthodox Jewish community leaders in North London, Community Secretary Michael Gove was quoted by a pro-Israel newspaper stating,
"The BDS campaign is not about running an ethical foreign policy. The BDS campaign is designed for only one purpose, to attack and delegitimize the state of Israel and the idea that there should be a Jewish state at all. The campaign has not only undermined efforts for peace in the Middle East, it also leads to community tension in the UK. We have seen an increase in anti-Semitic incidents, and the BDS campaign is a driver of that."
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. Pro-Israel groups have long lobbied British authorities to act against the practice. Those demands appear to have been answered, with plans announced to ban economic and cultural boycotts of Israel, with new anti-BDS legislation announced during the Queen's speech on May the 10th, a move slammed by pro-Palestine activists.
First and foremost, I think Israel is really concerned with its accesses against the Palestinians, and the civil society is rising up against them. This concern obviously means that the supporters of Israel want to make sure that Israel can continue with its occupation and they want to close down all potential avenues that highlights the Israeli aggression and human rights violation. And therefore, we see the British government, the Conservative government, who's very close to Israel, to stop the British citizens from trying